the Animator Mode 7.7, every other process running in the domain user_t, and most processes run by user_role users will have full access to the file, but not processes running from users who are in different roles and not daemons. So, for example, a user won't be able to do symlink attacks against daemons by creating symlinks in the temp directory, because the daemons will not have permission to read the symlinks. SE Linux is based around the Linux Security Modules framework, known as LSM. The LSM framework is a framework for security modules. These modules can be loaded dynamically as kernel modules, or in the usual case, they'll be compiled into the kernel. Generally regarded as being a bad idea to load an LSM module as a kernel module, because there's an issue of what happened before the module was loaded. In the case of SE Linux, there was initial work to make it load as a module. This work was abandoned because it was believed that there was no way for SE Linux, if loaded late in the process, to fully catch up with what had been done first and apply appropriate labels to existing resources. So it's like the thing to do is have SE Linux running right from the start, and then it's compiled into the kernel. SE Linux uses features of role based on domain type access control. Domain type is the main form of access control, whereby every process has a security domain associated with it, and every object a process may access has a type. And we have a set of rules mapping domains to types and specifying what access is to be granted. Role-based access control, it's not the same as what's known as RBAC. RBAC systems are different because you have a role assigned to each user who logs in, and that role directly determines access to be granted. So in some ways, a role in RBAC system is somewhat comparable to a domain in SE Linux. In SE Linux, the role limits which domains you may use. So if you log in and your role is user_R, it's the unprivileged user role, then therefore you can't have a process running in this setup_t domain, the domain for administrative processes. And that's how roles work. It has to constrain which domains may be used. SE Linux tracks user identity through all operations. Part of the SE Linux security context is the identity. And the identity will be the Unix account name of a user assigned when they log in, if there is a matching identity compiled in the policy. If there is no identity compiled in the policy to match their username, it will be user_u, the default identity. And this identity will be tracked through all operations. So if you've compiled someone's identity into the policy, and they log in, their process will be labeled with this identity, and everything they do will have the same identity. So they can run set UID or set GID programs if your policy permits that, and their identity will not change. So the UID might change, but the identity won't. So therefore, all log messages will refer to the identity, and you'll be able to determine what the logs refer to. SE Linux removes the power of UID 0. As I mentioned in my previous talk this morning, I've run machines with an open root password, giving UID 0 to everyone on the net, and SE Linux fully controls access and prevents them doing anything I want them to do. Now, the LSM framework. It was devised at the request of Linus. I believe it was the Linux kernel summit 2001 where this originally happened. What happened was there were presentations made to Linus from several groups. One group was the NSA advocating SE Linux. There was people from Hewlett-Packard advocating the Hewlett-Packard manufacturing control system, and there was a few others. Every group was saying, we've got our security system and we think it should be the Linux security system, and we think that ours is better than everyone else's. And they all had various reasons for believing their system was better. Linus didn't want to be involved in this. He said, okay, I don't want to make a decision here. I want an interface so that all of these things can work, and that every Linux user can choose which of your systems to use, which matches their needs best. So he demanded that some sort of interface be designed. And so the LSM project was begun to deliver this. And so the core of the LSM project is a set of interfaces and a set of hooks to various parts of the kernel code which are relevant to security. So operations such as opening a file, reading a file, writing a file, renaming a file, making a directory, all these operations are hooked via LSM hooks, and then we have access control based around these hooks. And the mechanism of access control is separate. So with SE Linux we have fairly strict controls, and it turns out the way things worked is that only the SE Linux developers were fully involved with the LSM development project. So that means that everything that the Esalink's project needed is supported in LSM. Because any time that something Esalink's needed wasn't there, they'd immediately send a patch in, provide the support. The patch would be rewritten as many times as necessary to make it a suitable quality, and then it was accepted. So now the LSM code, which went into 2.6.2 kernel, did everything that Esalink needed, and then Esalink was included in the kernel. So now, since 2.6.2, the standard kernel raw kernel has Esalink in it as a standard feature because of the LSM project. The other competing security projects, they weren't involved in the LSM development process at their own choice, and they chose to not make their projects work with the LSM, and the result is that because of this, their projects are not candidates for inclusion in the standard kernel source tree. One of the features of LSM, it's based around restrictive controls only. So if Unix permissions don't permit an operation, an LSM module cannot permit it. This is mildly controversial. Most people think this is a good thing, because, for example, with SELinux, no matter how badly you mess up your SELinux policy, you cannot make your machine less secure. And this is regarded as a good thing. People are afraid of the complexity of SELinux policy, so they're happy that they can't mess things up too badly. On the other hand, some people would rather have the ability to enable things, to commit things that are not normally to be permitted. The logic for this is there are certain operations for which in Unix permissions I have to grant the process root. So running an SELinux system, we have a process running as root for the Unix side permissions, which means you get everything on the Unix side, and then on SELinux we restrict it entirely. Whereas it might be more convenient perhaps to have a DHCP server not run as root, have SELinux override the Unix access controls on raw network access to permit this non-root process to have raw network access, and then have Unix permissions apply for file access. So there's a little debate about this, but the decision's been made, and it doesn't appear there's any change in the foreseeable future, so LSM is restricted only. There's also been a number of people who've been interested in making Unix permissions be an LSM module. And in theory, at least, there's nothing stopping people from making Unix permissions be an LSM module. They have an option of compiling kernel without them. So you have a kernel with only, for example, SELinux to control access, or perhaps for embedded systems, if you had a system running only a single process, you might decide to just have no access controls at all. There are a lot of machines out there running every process as root with nothing like SELinux on them to restrict access. And for those machines, you might say, okay, we could save 50k of kernel memory space if we had no access control. And if the Unix permissions became the LSM module, that could be done. Not many people like this idea, so this hasn't really happened and probably won't happen. Okay, problems with Unix security. The first problem is because of Unix security being discretionary access control, also known as DAC, programs have full control of the resources they create. For example, they can create a file in temp directory and make it world readable and world writable. This can be through malicious programs trying to inappropriately share data, or it can be just through design errors. One example is there was a Java development environment released for Linux a few years ago, and people who developed this Java IDE had the idea that you purchase a machine for the sole purpose of doing Java programming. And so therefore, every person who has an account on the machine has an account for the purpose of Java programming. So only your Java programmers are there, and therefore all Java programmers should get access to all Java source code. This is a database of all our source code in a temp directory and make it world readable and world writable. And that's how the code works. And trying to make things work in the same fashion on a more user system in regard to a program like this is just impossible. Whereas with SELinux, in the default configuration, you'd have a role, you might say, okay, use underscore R roles for Java. And everyone who logs on with that role has access to the Java files. It will be user underscore T and P underscore T, a derived type for files these people create in the temp directory. And anyone who's in the other role, apart from the administrator, of course, can't access those files. And so therefore, without even any change to the default configuration, you suddenly lock down Java in this case. And so a problem that would have been insolvable using Unix permissions is trivially solvable with SELinux. Another problem is that Unix permissions are too coarse-grained. In many ways, it's effectively a Boolean security model. So if you have a daemon, most daemons tend to run as root because they need to have one or maybe two things they need to do that require root access. So a DHCP server needs to raw network access so it can receive packets from machines that have no IP address assigned to them. And it has root access to that. So a DHCP server can write to the shadow file and write to your own home directory because it needs to do network access. Your DHCP client needs to have raw network access and to be able to change your IP address. And because of this, it has full access to the machine. It can write block devices, write to the shadow file, and this is ridiculous. So with SELink, we have very strict fine-grained access controls. So these servers are locked down, such that the DHCP server can only write to its own state files, read configuration files, and do raw network access. And so if your DHCP server is compromised, and there has been a bug in the DHCP server in the past, so this is something that could possibly happen again, an attacker can't write the shadow password file, they can't write to your home directory, or do anything else bad. So if you're running a server, and it's running a DHCP server, and you realise the server had a bug in it, all you have to do is kill the processes running in the DHCPD underscore T domain, which is the DHCP server and any process that you've launched. Then you install a new version. You might need to delete the state file in case you're worried about some bad data in the state file, and then start the new daemon. And it's a pretty simple process, and you've upgraded the machine, you've solved the security issue, and that's all you need to do. Whereas if you're not running SELinux, you need to change all the passwords of all the users who have accounts on that machine, because the attacker might have got a copy of the shadow file and run crack on it. If a user's got the same password on several machines, you might need to change passwords on all the machines. You might need to look at where people have logged into machines from, because maybe someone cracked your DHCP server machine, got the passwords from that, logged other machines around the network. The extent of the damage is very wide-ranging. Another example is if someone cracked the DHCP server, because it's running as root, they could then sniff logins and sniff passwords and then follow people as logging on the machine. So, for example, someone who logged into the DHCP server and then ran SSH from there to log in the other machine would give away their account on the machine as well, similar to the Debian server crack you might have all heard about. Another problem with user security is security model doesn't allow tracking of identity across change of UID. So when a person runs a setUID program, anything that program might do might be logged as the UID of that program if it's going to be logged at all. Often it's not logged, which is not a problem. But if it is logged, it will be logged on the UID of the program that they'd run, the setUID program, not their own UID. So when someone runs a setUID program that allows inappropriate things, there's no record of who did it. So you have 1,000 users on the machine, and one person ran the setUID program that had a security hole and exploited it, and you don't know who it was. So all you do is fix the bug and hope they can't do it again. Okay, domain type access control. Every process is a domain, and every object that a process may access, be a file, directory, network socket, etc., has a type. And we have a database of rules mapping domains to types, specifying what access to be granted. One thing to note is that SELinux doesn't strongly distinguish between domains and types. So a domain is just a subset of a type namespace that applies to your process. So the difference between a domain is, in effect, the type of a process. For every option that every operation that may be permitted, you may permit any of the possible operations on the object. It's much more fine-grained than the Unix permissions, which are based on just read-write execution, or in some cases, either full access or no access. So, for example, with a file, Unix permissions can permit any of read, write, and execute, whereas with SELinux, you can permit getAtter for an LS minus L type operation, setAtter for a CH mod or CH own, append, read, write, IOCTL, unlink, rename, and these are all can be called controlled independently. Some of these things can almost be done using Unix permissions. An example is having append access. You can use chattr to control that. For a question there? Okay. Another one is immutable files. So you can make a file immutable, make it read-only, even by root processes. However, what you can't do with Unix permissions is have a file be immutable or append-only for process A, but have full read-write for process B, and maybe have no access at all for process C. And you can't do this using Unix permissions, whereas with SELinux, this is standard configuration. In terms of the domain just being a subset of the type namespace, the files under the slash proc directory that correspond to a process have the same type as process itself. for example, if you have a process running in the domain user underscore t, the file is related to that process. So slash proc slash the PID number directory, that has the type user underscore t as well. The domain of process will use as the target context for the file operations used for PS and TOP to examine information in the process state, and also for inter-process communication, such as sending signals. So if you want to send a signal to the process, you have to be given permission to do that, based on Linux. Now, in the original design of Linux, the domain of process, to be more precise, the security context, which consists of more than the domain, could only be changed at exec time. So when a process was running, there was no equivalent of a setuid call to allow a process to change security credentials while it's running. It had to exec another process, which could be executing itself, for that matter, to change its domain or any part of the security context. This is a design feature, the idea being that if you allow a process to change security context while it's running, due to bugs that are very hard to track down in processes, the process will probably have some data in its address space, that is, from before it changed its credentials. So, for example, in Unix permissions, a process that calls setuid, there was some data in its address space from before it called setuid. If it's calling setuid to decrease privileges, it might have some secret data, like perhaps part of the shadow password file, still in memory somewhere. It might not even know about this, even the author of the program might not know about it, because some library components and side effects they don't understand. On the other hand, a program that uses setuid to increase privileges could have the opposite problem of some hostile data who read, corrupting its state, causing it to do something unexpected when it changes to a more privileged context. So as a design feature, it was designed such that these things were not permitted. For a process to change its security context, it had to call exec, which could be executing itself. So you could ask the kernel to replace the process with another could be the same process with a different context, and that would allow it to change security context without risk of attacking those manners. Now, the problem with this, of course, was file servers. Both NFS4 and SAMBA file servers were based around the idea of having a single connection being used for sharing file data for more than one user context. And if you want to have the file server have its file serving process running in a context derived from the file serving, the file client context, so you log on as user A into the file server, and you have a process on the file server running on your behalf with the credentials for user A, Linux access controls are enforced at the file server level. If you want to do that with SAMBA, that was impossible under the previous design of Linux, because you could have several different users using the same TCP socket, for example, for NT terminal server. And there was a possibility of hacking the design of SAMBA to a special case for, say, Unix clients where you only have a single UID used for one TCP socket. This is considered just bad design, so it was reluctantly agreed that the only way to do this properly was to allow some equivalent to set FSUID. So there is now policy to allow, within a certain set of domains, transitions of a similar nature to setuid. But the policy, of course, controls these domains. So you might say, okay, we have three domains we can transition between arbitrarily, but the rest of the domain system cannot be entered. This is opposed to Unix permissions, whereby if you can call setuid, you can do it to any UID you wish, and the whole thing is open to you. One of the features about SELinux is there is no hierarchy inherent to SELinux. In Unix permissions, you have UID0 being the ultimate authority. So UID0 has all permissions under the Unix access control scheme, and every other UID has less permission than that. With SELinux, there is no enforced hierarchy, and there is no inherent need for any domain to have more access than other domains. In practice, though, we have a domain, sysadm underscore t, which has most privileges, because this is the way people work. When you as a system administrator want to be running a machine, you want to be able to do almost every operation, and you need to do these things just as part of your work. So SELinux has the policy to match to suit the needs of the administrator, not because it had no flexibility, just because this is how it was chosen to figure it. And one thing to note is that there is one specific access that's denied to the administrator domain, system underscore T. That is, the administrator domain cannot directly access the shadow file. The reason for this is some administrators may run a shell script or something to munge the shadow password file and create a new one. So the way you run the script is you would read the shadow file, write the data out to a temporary file, and use MV to copy it over the old one. The problem with this is the shadow file has a special SUNIX label, shadow underscore T, to indicate it's being different from all the other configuration files because it has such important and secret data. Now, if you create a new file in the etc directory, the old files in the etc directory is having world readable because most files in the etc directory are designed for world reading. So you create a new file, your temporary file in the etc directory, and it's world readable, and it's got the shadow password data. You rename it over top of the real shadow file, and suddenly your shadow file has lost all its protection. So we don't want to allow this. So prevent this sort of mistake, which can be easily done even by a skilled administrator, if they forget which machine they're using. It's like, this is my Linux machine, this is my normal Unix machine. I'll do a command A here, command B here. Oops, I chose the wrong machine and I've broken my security. So in the SELinux strict policy, the administrator has to use the tools, user add, user del, VIPW, password, etc., to modify the shadow file. And they can't just edit it with VI or something, as they might otherwise do. Incidentally, this is of course a configuration option. So an SELinux administrator who doesn't like this policy can always change it themselves and do whatever they want. Yes? Which bug was that? Okay. Yeah, we don't have the bug anymore. Okay. So the question is, what happens if you have a bug in a program like VIPW that labels the file incorrectly? The policy for the utilities such as VIPW and password with the strict SELinux policy is when they create a file in the etc directory, by default it has type shadow underscore C. So that's the way it starts, and the program then has to specifically request the file be relabeled. So you could have a bug whereby the program accidentally specifically requested the shadow file have a type change to etc underscore C. But that would be a very unlucky bug to have. The more likely bug is a bug of omission, like it's got to make an operation, such as perhaps forgetting to set the UMAS in this Red Hat 7.2 issue you described. So if someone made a change to the password or user add program, and they forgot to label the files back to the correct context, the result of that would be the password file itself would not be labeled back, which is actually a bad thing, because it would deny almost every program access to the password file, therefore your login program couldn't let you log in, and your machine wouldn't be very usable. It will be secure. With the strict policy, one of the general aim we have is to have it fail closed. So if something goes wrong, we would rather the machine not be usable than it be insecure. So if it's not usable, you can go back and fix the bug. If it's insecure, you won't notice it's insecure because it will just keep working. And you'll have it run perhaps for years being insecure before you realise, and it's too late. So if it fails and fails closed, you know within perhaps minutes that something's wrong. We'll fix it up and problem solved. And that's the sort of general design aim. One thing I should mention at this stage is that we have two main policies for SELinux, the strict policy and the targeted policy, which I briefly mentioned before. The targeted policy is aimed for maximum usability. And in the targeted policy, you can run VI on the shadow file. And all the user login domains are running with the domain, all the user sessions, sorry, are running with the domain unconfined underscore T. So you log in as root, you get unconfined T domain, which gives you no restrictions for SELinux, and you can therefore just edit the shadow file with VI. It's not recommended, but it'll work if you want to do that. Now, with strict policy, the user can change their SELinux credentials at any time. If they have more than one set of credentials they can choose from, using the program new role. So an example of new role is you might log in via SSH with the staff role, staff underscore R, then you run new role minus R, sysadm underscore R, change the administrator role. This is similar to the standard Unix administrator practice of SSH into a machine as non-root and then run su minus to go to root and gives you much the same benefits. But there is one additional benefit to this, is that the policy was the strict policy for SELinux was changed after the last SHD bug, At the last time this HDB came out, it was believed by many people, not proven, but it was widely believed, that SSHD was exploitable. And that would mean that an attacker could crack SSHD and get a root login to your machine through that without a password. This hasn't been proved, but it's been suspected. Now, if that was the case, and because we're concerned about security, we'll assume the worst. So we'll assume that this event, even though it seems unlikely, assume that it was the case. So if it's the case, then we don't want to have SE Linux commit SSHD to launch a process in the initial context. So we change the policy to not allow SSHD to start a shell as sysadm _r role. And this means that the user will have to log in as a different role and then run a new role to get the privileges. So an attacker who cracks through SSHD will get a less privileged role, and they'll then have to perhaps try and crack a new role or try and get a password or some other mechanism to try and get administrative privileges. So it greatly increases the amount of effort they have to go to get administrative access in the box. Of course, if they can get access to every non-administrative user's home directory, they still do a lot of damage. And if your machine is, for example, a shell server, perhaps that's all they want to do, is get access to the shell accounts. So they may be able to fully achieve their goals without cracking root as such. But in the case of a server, perhaps a DNS server or a DHCP server or something, where all you do is log onto the machine to administrative work, this will protect the machine. And if you have an SSHD bug, all you have to do is walk to the console of the machine, upgrade SSHD, kill any previous instances, and your problem is solved. Now, the number of domains within this policy can vary according to the needs. So, for example, the strict policy has a large number of domains to greatly restrict access to each process. Every process has minimum privileges needed to perform its operations. And on the other hand, the targeted policy has a far smaller number of domains. One example of which it has no domains for user login sessions. So all user logins run in the same domain. This gives less security, but also makes it easier to administer. And so the general rule is that the more domains you have, the more security you can get through greater control of resources, but also the more difficulty you have in administering the machine. As a trivial case, if you had an SE Linux machine with only one domain, that one domain would then need to be granted full access, and you therefore have the same result as an SE Linux system. So it's the sort of absurd case. Now, for the role-based access control, as mentioned before, it's not what's referred to as RBAC. RBAC uses a sort of a slang term, means access control directly based on role. So you have a role, and that role directly determines your access. In SE Linux, role determines which domains you may enter. So, for example, if you're in the user role, you may have the user domain for your process. If you're in the staff role, you have the staff _t domain. And then the domain then determines access to be granted for that process. So the role is an indirect method of controlling access. So at login time, the login process, whether it be /bin/login, SSHD, or GDM for an X login, will determine the identity for your login session, which if your identity has been compiled, if your username has been compiled into this thing's policy, it will be your username, otherwise it will be user_u. And then it will select a role that considers most appropriate for that identity. And in the case of SSHD and /bin/login, you can, if you're permitted to use more than one role, you may choose between roles to use for your login session. For GDM, we don't use the default every time. The reason for that is that an X login creates many temporary files, and different contexts for a user login would mean different contexts for those files. And if a file context doesn't match the context of the process, you won't have the access. And logging in via X as one user role and then through a different one would just cause problems. So we decided not to support that feature. So when you log in, your identity determines your role, the role then determines the domain, and domain then determines the access you get granted. I mentioned before that the process may change its security context at execution time. There are two ways of doing this. One way is through requesting a change of context. For example, your login process will choose the context that's appropriate for your user ID and request that the kernel change that context the next time it executes a process, which will be your shell. There's also automatic transitions. So, for example, in Fedora, when you are logged in as administrator and you start a daemon, there'll be an automatic transition from the context of the administrator to the context the daemon runs in. So both the role and the domain will change automatically at execution time based on rules and incidents policy, which I'll describe later. Now here's a diagram of how identities work in SE Linux. So in this diagram, we've got a machine with two identities. There's the root identity and the VOH identity. This is the configuration you might use for an SE Linux play machine. So root identity is only permitted to use the role user underscore R. And the role user underscore R is only permitted to use the domain user underscore T for its initial login, and a small other number of related domains. On the other hand, the VOH identity is permitted to use either the user underscore R role or sysadmin underscore R role. And the sysadmin underscore R role can use the sysadmin underscore T domain and therefore full access. So if you want to have administrative access to the machine, you should log in as VOH. So if you log in as root, you won't get it. Now, as mentioned before, access control is checked on SE Linux after Unix access control is checked. So a non-root process, a process with a UID other than 0 on SE Linux machine, cannot be used for administration. So in this example, you have the BOFH account used for administration. The BOFH account would have to have a UID of 0, or after logging out as BOFH, you have to use SU to change to an account that has UID 0 before you have to do administration. Now, here's a diagram of domain transitions used in the typical startup of a system. Now, at the top of the diagram, do we have a laser pointer? No? Okay. Can't see one. Ah, it doesn't matter. I'll just describe it. Okay. At the top of the diagram, we've got the domain kernel underscore C. So any thread or process created by the kernel has the domain kernel underscore C. So this is used for actual kernel processes, such as for certain device drivers have their own kernel thread, which runs kernel underscore C all the time. And it's also used for the kernel when it wants to launch user space processes. And the first example of which is init. So kernel wants to launch init, so it starts off a user space process, executes init, and this is before SE Linux policy is loaded. So before SE Linux policy is loaded, everything runs in the kernel domain. And so SE Linux policy is actually loaded by the init process. So the first thing init does when it's first started up, it checks for, it mounts the proc file system is not mounted. It checks for the presence of an SE Linux file system entry in slash proc slash file systems. Because if SE Linux FS is not a valid file system type, then the kernel will not compile with SE Linux support, and therefore it's not an SE Linux machine at all. So if the kernel is compiled with SE Linux support, we'll then go and try and load the policy. So it has to load, mount the file system SE Linux of type SE Linux FS, which by default is mounted on slash SE Linux, although it could be mounted somewhere else, just we've all chosen to use slash SE Linux. So this SE Linux FS file system is mounted, and then the process of loading the policy is to write it into a special file in that file system. So init writes that into that file, and then the kernel applies the change. Now, after that, the init process is still running in the kernel underscore T domain, because it can only change domain when it calls exec. So what init does then, after it's loaded the policy, it execs itself. So because it re-execs itself, there's a domain transition rule in SE Linux policy, which I've got up there on the right. Domain auto-trans, the first parameter is the source domain, kernel underscore C. So process running in the kernel underscore T domain, then executes a file of type init underscore exec underscore T. So that's the type of the file slash sbin slash init. And the rule says when that execution takes place, automatically transition to domain init underscore T. So after that exec, init is then running again in the domain init underscore T, which then uses to do its normal system boot process. So one of all the things the init does, it runs the system setup scripts, which on Red Hat systems is rc.sysinit, the first one. So rc.sysinit has a type of int rc underscore exec underscore T. And you'll notice that we've got a rule saying domain autotrans, int underscore T, int rc exec T, int rc underscore T. So it means init executes this script of type int rc exec T, automatically transitions to domain int rc underscore T, which is the domain used for starting daemons. And now example of this, this int rc underscore T domain launches catalogd. and callow D is a type, callow D is at T, and automatic transition occurs again to callow D underscore T, the main for callow D daemon. And a similar thing for running named. Now, on the left side of the diagram, we've got NS launches Getty to allow a console login. So again, main or trans rule for that. And then Getty launches slash bin slash login after you enter your username. And this transitions to local login T. I've got a little error in my diagram. Up here, instead of saying login underscore T, it should say local login T. There is no login underscore T domain or type in the Sequence policy. That was just a typo I made. So local login T, after it's authenticated the user, so it's checked the username and password and verified that this person is a valid password, there's no configuration denying them access to the machine. So they've got their live access to the machine, they've got a valid shell, etc. And so then login's going to execute a shell for them. What it does first, it determines the correct security context and then requests the kernel, the serverless code in the kernel, apply a new security context for the process about to execute. So it tells the kernel the context it wants to have for this trial process and then calls exec to exec the shell. Now, you notice the policy, it has the rule domain trans, not domain auto trans. What domain trans does, domain auto trans will permit a transition of domains and make it default. Now, obviously, we can't have more than one default. While the login process may, on default configuration, have three different roles it can log in as, and may have more than that. So there's nothing stopping you configuring your Linux system to have 100 different user roles with 100 different domains to use to log in, and the login process can transition to any of them. Obviously, of course, no one can have as default. So we have the rule domain trans. So that permits the transition, but then the application has to specifically request it and won't happen by default. So the rule is domain trans, local login T, the domain of the process that it's called exec, shell exec T, the type of the shell, user domain. User domain is an attribute that specifies a set of domains. The set in a default configuration being user underscore T, staff underscore T, and system underscore T. That is all the domains that are permitted for a user shell when they log in. And in this example, we have a user logging in as user underscore T. Do we have any questions at this stage? Did I confuse you yet? Okay. Okay, now the policy. It's written in high-level info macros. I'll cover this in more detail in the next talk, so I won't mention much about it now. So when you compile a policy, macros are expanded, and then there's a program called check policy that compiles the policy to a binary form that kernel understands. Now the policy load process that I mentioned before involves just writing the policy binary to a special file, so that the policy binary is just sent directly to the kernel without any interpretation. It's done by init at the start of the boot process. And also, a modified policy may be loaded at any time. So any time the user administrator may change the policy, compile the changed policy, and then load it. There are some restrictions, of course. For example, if you change the policy and either remove the definition from a type, or make a domain not be permitted to be part of a role, or make a role not permitted to use for user identity, then security contexts that have these combinations that have now become invalid will change to the domain unlabeled underscore T. So, example, if a user's logged in and you change you load a new policy that undefines their identity or doesn't permit them to use the role they were using, then suddenly their process will become unlabeled. Unlabeled process only permits to do one thing, that is send sig trial to init. So this will give the user a fairly fast log out. This is one a feature of SE Linux, is that often what has happened in a number of in many situations is that an administrator decides to cancel someone's account, but they don't think through all the issues. So for example, might change the password to lock someone out, but not to remove cron jobs. And you need to have a cron job which then gives them access to the machine. They might forget to remove .rhost files and equivalent files, or they might forget to kill running processes, and you might have a process still running there which allows the user to reconnect to it and regain access to their account. But this is Linux, if you change the policy to undefine their identity, then the processes are all gone, and they can't log in again, and they're gone for good. One thing to note about the way that the processes are invalidated, it is possible to load a policy that is vastly different from when you're running. For example, you'll be running a strict policy, and then tell a kernel to load the targeted policy. This will actually load, and then almost every domain that's in use will suddenly become invalid. And this means that almost every process in the system will be killed immediately, and the machine will stop. The solution to that is just don't do it. As many other things in Unix, you as the administrator have control, and you can destroy your system, so you just have to know not to do that. Okay, interface of the kernel. The initial releases of SE Linux had system calls for interfacing between user space and the kernel code. So the initial release had that, and the first LSM release had it. When it came time to try and merge the LSM code into the standard kernel tree, a lot of the serious kernel people, Davis Miller was one example, were very happy about this. One of the issues is that having system calls work correctly on architectures that are both 32-bit and 64-bit, such as Spark, is apparently very difficult and requires a lot of code, especially when you're doing what the LSM interface was doing. They had one LSM system call, which had its first parameter specified which LSM module to use. So you pass the SE Linux magic number to this, and then call the SE Linux kernel code. And SE Linux kernel code had 52 different system calls, which had another parameter. The second parameter of the system call was which of the 52 SE Linux system calls you wanted to do. And each of these SE Linux system calls had a different set of parameters. And this actually didn't work too badly, and there was a precedent for it. For those of you who are into kernel code, you'll know it's a socket call, whereby most of the TCP-related system calls will work with the same system call with a similar offset manner. But the consensus among the kernel coders is socket call was a mistake, not a mistake on a repeat, and this code is bad and it's not coming out again. So SE Linux was rewritten to use special files instead. So for a process to control its own SE Linux state, for example, a process wants to execute another process and determine the security context for the new process, this is used by a special file under /proc/self. Also, a process can specify the context of a new file it's going to create through the same interface through a special file under /proc/self. The process wants to know its context, the context of itself before it called exec, the current process was executed. Or if a process such as PS wants to find a list of the contents of all the processes, again uses files in the proc directory. So these are all system calls that went away. There were system calls SE Linux to do things such as load policy, to toggle the machine between permissive and forcing mode. Permissive mode is where SE Linux just logs what it would deny. It doesn't actually deny them. In forcing mode, it denies the operations that it wants to deny. And you can toggle between the two on a machine compiled with what they call development mode enabled. And this was done through system calls previously, but now it's all done through special file systems like SE Linux FS. So now that there's no SE Linux or LSM specific system calls, and this is a prerequisite of getting the code into the standard kernel. Now, another thing is, in the first releases of SE Linux, there were system calls to change the security context of files on disk. In the initial release of SE Linux, they had a modified version of EXC2, which had a modified version of FSCK, a modified version of NKFS, etc., which is a lot of fun for people, I guess. System calls to specify the security context, which would cause changes to this extra metadata in the file system. Disregard is a bad idea. Having custom code in the file system to handle it really wasn't widespread. So the second version of SE Linux, which is the first version using LSM, had a database. So you have three special files in a special directory on the file system. So every file system had a root, in its root directory, had a directory named ./.security. This directory had three files, which were normally not visible to the system. Being a .dot directory, it wasn't visible in ls minus lapp in a normal case. And there were SE Linux access controls preventing access to them in any other way. And these files contained a mini database mapping inode number to security context. This also didn't work so well because it wasn't part of the file system interface, and therefore it was difficult to get an atomic update, and there's situations where if a machine crashed at the wrong time, you could get the wrong context and files, which was pretty bad. So the interface that's used now in SE Linux, which is the final version, is to use an XEditor. So this works on any file system that has XEditor support, so that is at this time EC2, EC3, XFS, JFS, and I believe YJFS has been fixed to work now. And for any other file system that has XFS support will also, XEditor support will also work. So there's now currently work in progress in getting JFS2 to have XEditor support to work with SE Linux. So now we have an XEditor named security.SELinux, which is used for security context. So a process to view the security context of the file, they just get the XEditor of the file. So we've got a modified version of ls in this Linux patch version of core utils, which does this. So ls just will query the XEditor on the files. Also, if you happen to have an SLinux machine without the modified version of ls, which could be the case in some situations, there's a utility called to get the XEditors of the file directly, and you can just run the utility to get the same result. Also, if you were perhaps concerned about your bug in ls, you would use the utility to verify it. And again, to change the security context of the file, you just change the value of this XEditor. And so there's numerous tools to work with this. And also, some of the backup programs also have support for it. So having a backup program supports some backup of XEditors. Sending it to support the security of SELinux namespace as well is a minor change. Whereas prior to that, having this Linux system calls is more work. So you can compile a backup program without using any SE Linux header files or libraries, and have it back up SE Linux security context of files. Okay, distinguished characteristics of SE Linux. One of the first features of SE Linux that distinguishes it from some of the other X control systems is in SE Linux, access is based around the inode, not the file name. So, for example, if you have a file with numerous hard links, it will have numerous names, each of which are equally valid. And if you have an access control system based around file name, you can end up with having several different levels of access control applied to the file based on the name. So if you can't access the file based on name 1, try name 2 and see if that works. This isn't very productive. And the common criteria specify that for a common criteria evaluation, an operating system must not have such a limitation. So there must be one canonical labeling of the file for access, and for a Unix system that means it must be done on the inode. So for this reason, SE Linux based the access control on the inode. The XEditor for the file is stored in the associated with the inode. So it might be either stored in the inode or the inode will have a pointer to it. In either case, you will name a file, you don't change the security context. Whereas some other access control systems, you name a file, you change the security, you change access to the file. The file type can be assigned to a file by sending the XEditor, but also can be assigned at mount time. So you can mount a file system and specify all files in the file system to have a certain security context, which is and not use the XEditors. Example of this is if you have a server that has a large number of files, such as a mail server. If you have a mail server serving mail for 1 million users, you might have 100 million files on there. You don't really want to have 100 million file labels and the possibility of having to check 100 million file labels if file system is corrupted or something. So you just mount the file system with a mount option that's found in security context. And then all files in the same context, it doesn't waste any space. It might save some trivial amount of CPU time even, and generally makes it easier. SELinux requires modified utilities and applications to use full functionality. This is cited by competing projects as a limitation of SELinux. I don't think this is for several reasons. One reason, of course, is that in Fedora, all the utilities are patched. Our distribution is getting it too. So Gentoo has the patches in all the utilities and applications. Debian is getting it. So basically, pretty soon, every distribution is going to get it. There are already many of the modified programs where the patches have been shipped upstream. Fcron had the SELinux patch shipped upstream about 3 years ago. So once we get all these patches upstream, it won't be a hardship for anyone to compile the program to SELinux support. With Debian, the user will have an option of installing the machine with or without SELinux, as they have with Gentoo. This doesn't necessarily mean you want to compile the programs without the SELinux support, because in most cases, SE Linux adds about 3 or 4K of disk space in executable. So you have a program like Login, which is about 70K in size, and make it 73K. You're not really wasting much disk space over your entire system. And so there's really no cost to it. What the code does, the first thing it does is it checks, is SE Linux active? If the answer is no, it stores a Boolean for that and never checks again. So there's really no overhead at all. Now, it would be possible to write an SLinux policy that's simpler, had less features, and didn't require modified utilities. Anyone could do this, and it wouldn't be that much work. No one has bothered doing so, because basically there isn't anyone who believes there's enough benefit to be obtained through this. If you want to use SLinux to get full benefits, then you need to have the modified utilities, and people want the full benefits. Another big feature of SELinux compared to other Mac systems is its fully configurable Wi-Fi policy. So you as an SELinux user, if you say, for example, install Fedora Core 3 or Fedora Core 4 or Hardened Gentoo or Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4, you can fully configure your machine based around policy. So you edit the policy source files, compile it and load it, edit some configuration files to specify the default context for logins, and you can change every aspect of how SELinux works without changing any of the applications. I believe there have been some other Unix systems by managed Rex control, whereby they had some of the actual policy compiled into the binaries. This meant if you wanted to change the policy, you had to change the binaries, which is very annoying for people who are doing this, that they change the C source code and recompile it. So even for people who worked for the Unix vendor, this is an annoyance. However, it was much worse for the users. If you're a customer of a commercial version of Unix and has a managed access control system where the policy is compiled into binaries, what are you going to do? Are you going to write your own bin login because you want to change the way make things work and your vendor doesn't want to change their login policy to match your requirements? You're really stuck and your flexibility is limited because of this. This means you don't have these sorts of limits. I think it's probably my last slide anyway. Do we have any questions at this stage? Yes? Yes, the question is... Okay, the question is, can you use SELinux to lock down CGI scripts? The answer is yes. And in the strict policy, for every... user role, there will be a matching CGI domain. So if that user creates the CGI script, they'll then have to label the file appropriately, and then an automatic domain transition when either the HTTPD or SUXEC executes the script will transition to the domain, and then it will run without access to the main web server itself, and without access to other CGI bin scripts. So you have several CGI bin scripts running in the same UID, or even running as UID0. Running on behalf of different users and have SELinux restrict the access. And we have access to certain things such as perhaps access to the user's home directory. This is configurable. There are some booleans to configure this. One thing I should mention is that there's two main ways of configuring SELinux. One way is by modifying the policy. And the policy has been designed to allow certain modifications easily. So you can, for example, remove the configuration for remove a policy file for a daemon, recompile a policy, and then other daemons might have access restricted based on this. So, for example, if there's a MySQL policy loaded in, Apache will have access to talk to MySQL, and Apache won't have access to those files and directories if MySQL policy isn't loaded in. The booleans, however, allow runtime configuration of SELinux. So you can change this boolean value by the administrator at runtime, and that will change the SELinux operations that are committed. And this can include things such as whether Apache can execute CGI scripts. So you have an Apache server running with no CGI scripts, and then your user sends you an email and says, hey, I want to run CGI scripts now. I'll put my CGI script in and it's not working. And you go, okay, I'll change my Apache security policy to match this. So I'll change the boolean to now permit this execution of CGI scripts. The question is, how long does it take to set up from scratch SELinux with a Apache MySQL server? If you're running Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4 or Fedora, SELinux is on by default. So you just do a default install and have SELinux. It has the targeted policy, not the strict policy. Fedora Fedora Core 3 and Fedora Core 4 have both strict and targeted as part of the set of packages in distribution. Target is the default, and you can install strict if you wish. Fedora Core 2 had only strict, which caused a lot of complaints, and that's why we had to develop the targeted policy. Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4 has only targeted policy. There are no packages for strict policy in the RHEL 4 distributions, the non-CDs. This is because strict policy is not a supported feature of Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4. Supported features for Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4 only include the targeted policy. So if you call up the Red Hat Global Support Services support line and say you've got a problem with Enterprise Linux 4 and targeted policy, if you have a support agreement with Red Hat, then your question will get answered. If you call up about strict policy, they won't get answered from your question. They might do so just as a courtesy if they can, but the support staff aren't trained in issues of appearing strict policy, and the official response is you should contact GPS, Red Hat Global Professional Services team, and arrange to have them help you. And they'll charge you for an hourly wait for support for strict policy. So anyway, back to configuring the thing. If you configure the target policy, it's much easier to configure than strict policy. So if you install RHEL 4 or Fedora Core 4 or Fedora Core 3 in a default configuration, you'll have a policy for these daemons in place. And the default policy will be fairly close to what most people want to use. So if you're not doing anything very adventurous, then you probably just find this works. So you just use your regular Apache configuration, talking to MySQL, running PHP scripts, running CJavian scripts, and you'll just work out of the box. If you do things a bit unusually, such as use different directories for files, or if you have some unusual programs being called, or you try to do things that really perhaps aren't recommended, like, for example, you want to have a CJavian script change users' passwords, that's not recommended. If you do things like that, then the default policy won't do what you want, and you'll change the policy. But if you do things that are within the normal the range of things that most people want to do, and don't involve doing things that have great security risks, then it should just work out of the box. So I'd expect that for most Apache MySQL servers, you install Fedora or Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4, and it'll just work. And I think there are a lot of people running such servers, they don't even know they're using Linux, it just worked for them. Okay, do we have more questions? Yes? The question is it possible for an administrator to create a policy to lock themselves out and not allow them making a change in the future? The answer is yes, certainly. Xlinux controls everything, including loading new policy. And in fact, during the early stages of Xlinux development, throughout my first, throughout the last 3 months of 2001, when I was during the early stages of Xlinux development, my machine wouldn't work in enforcement mode. So every time I turned my machine into enforcement mode, things stopped working and I was locked out of my own machine. So demonstrating what you're requesting, but not in quite the same way. This was locking out inappropriately. But now we've got a boolean for secure mode, and one thing we plan to do for the development policy is to have several booleans for different aspects of secure levels. In BSD, Unix, one of the BSDs, I can't remember which one it might use, I can't remember if it's free or open BSD, one of those two has secure levels. And you have levels, this is a boolean value from about 0 to 3, one number means runs in normal fashion, and it change the numbers to change the level access control. And this does things such as preventing mounting or unmounting file systems, preventing rebooting machines, etc. And so if you set the highest secure level, it means the administrator can't do most administrative tasks, and the machine will just keep running in its current configuration. And you'd have to then go to the console to reboot the machine to get it back into a state where you can administer it. And this is made a little harder for attackers. And what we plan to do is have booleans for the same thing. So you can configure your Linux machine, get to a stage where you're happy with it and you want to run for a year like that, change a couple of booleans, and then you're locked out, and it will run for a long time like that. Okay, do you have any more questions? Okay, thank you for your time.